We know that in Alaska, trying to pay for things by way of a toll road, it's not going to work for us.
President Trump's infrastructure plan draws skepticism from Alaska senators. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, MATSU politicians oppose Governor Walker's replacement for Senator Dunleavy.
Disappointment in the governor not following the process and disregarding the folks of the district.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
The White House today presented its long-promised infrastructure plan. It's getting mixed reviews from Alaska's U.S. senators.
You've got a specific set aside for rural infrastructure. That's good, but the devil's going to be in the details here.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says she has to examine the funding rules to make sure Alaska can benefit from the $50 billion intended for rural areas. Nationally, President Trump's plan aims to build $1.5 trillion in transportation projects and public works, but the federal government would put up just $200 billion. The rest would come from state, local, and private funds. Murkowski has her doubts about private investment.
You know, we know that in Alaska, trying to pay for things by way of a toll road, it's not going to work for us.
She also cast doubt on the state's ability to provide significant matching funds. More subtly, Murkowski says she'll be on the lookout for requirements that include cost-benefit ratios. Alaska projects cost a lot and benefit relatively few. Murkowski says Alaska doesn't do well when federal funding requests are judged on per capita costs.
It's criteria like that that, for me, could not only be very worrisome, but be really a death knell for a state like Alaska in our ability to be treated fairly.
She says she'll learn more about the infrastructure proposal at a White House meeting on Wednesday. Senator Dan Sullivan is pleased the plan includes environmental permitting reform to speed up the time it takes to get a project started. He says regulatory efficiency is an idea that appeals to Republicans and Democrats. Environmental groups, though, say the plan would weaken environmental safeguards. MATSU Borough Assembly member Randall Kowalki has been appointed by Governor Bill Walker to fill a vacant Senate seat. But MATSU Republican legislators are opposing the appointment. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
After Mike Dunleavy resigned his seat in the Alaska Senate in January, local branches of the Alaska Republican Party began the process of coming up with a short list of potential replacements. The list was forwarded to Governor Bill Walker, who effectively chose none of the above by appointing MATSU Borough Assembly Member Randall Kowalki. Kowalki says he welcomed the news that he was Walker's choice.
Well, I was pleased because I think the governor recognized the work that I had been doing for the borough. I mean, that's how we interfaced. Additionally, when the governor's at his recreational property, he's actually a constituent of mine, and I've mentioned that to him a couple times in jest, of course.
It's now up to Senate Republicans to decide whether Randall Kowalki is confirmed. At least some of his would-be colleagues plan to oppose Kowalki's appointment. Senator Shelley Hughes says she plans to vote against confirmation, but that it's not about whom the governor chose, but rather how he chose.
It isn't disappointment in the choice, it's disappointment in the governor not following the process and disregarding the folks of the district.
While the governor has the authority to go outside of party suggestions, Hughes says it circumvents the will of local constituents.
Do we respect the people in this process? Do we think that they know best who represents their interests and their positions? Or does the governor think he knows best who represents their interests and positions? I believe the people do.
Randall Kowalke says that in most cases, he would agree with the reasons that Hughes and other Matsu Valley legislators are opposing his confirmation, but he adds that he doesn't think he had a fair chance to be on the shortlist sent to Governor Walker. He says the process used by the Republican Party at the combined district meetings was broken due to issues with local party officials.
We had the chairman and the vice chairman of the District 10 party, for various reasons, wouldn't have appointed me to mow their lawn, let alone serve in the Senate.
District 10 Republican Party Chair Doyle Holmes was Kowalke's opponent in the tight race that Kowalke ultimately won to be seated on the Matsu Borough Assembly. Kowalke says Vice Chair Jim Houston was involved with litigation against the borough at the time the list was made. Austin Baird, spokesman for Governor Walker, says the governor believes Kowalke's business background and record as a member of the Matsu Borough Assembly make him, quote, uniquely qualified to fill the vacancy. Baird also says Walker received more positive feedback for Kowalke from Republicans in Juneau as well as mayors than the other three candidates presented by the Republican Party. In total, Baird says seven people were interviewed before Kowalke was ultimately chosen. Senate President Pete Kelly says he expects the discussion about Kowalke's confirmation to take place early this week. Kowalke says if he's approved, that he looks forward to working with the majority caucus and all Republicans in the Senate. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
There was good news for some marine mammal advocacy groups today. An appeals court upheld an Endangered Species Act listing for ringed seals. But with the release of President Trump's 2019 budget, the entire day wasn't a victory. Trump proposes eliminating federal dollars for several programs with a presence in Alaska. One of them is the Marine Mammal Commission, an independent oversight agency that reviews the federal management of marine mammals. Peter Thomas, the executive director, says he wasn't necessarily surprised by the cuts. Trump proposed zeroing out the funding for last fiscal year. But he says the work the commission does in Alaska is especially timely and important. It focuses on issues like subsistence hunting and climate change. And Thomas says the commission helps communicate Alaskans' concerns to policymakers in D.C.
We're in Washington, we're a long way away, and just having a better understanding of how things operate in Alaska and in Alaska Native communities can only help to bring understanding here to Washington.
The commission has brought Alaskans to the nation's capital to advocate and held listening sessions in the state to learn about climate effects on marine mammals. Trump's 2019 budget also proposes nixing federal dollars for Alaska Sea Grant, which supports research funding at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, among many other things. Senator Lisa Murkowski had this message for those worried about the proposed cuts.
Don't get too exercised about things if you see that it's been zeroed out. Again, this is just the first step in a very multi-step process.
Murkowski stated she hopes Alaskans will make it clear to the delegation what the funding priorities should be. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alan Moore comfortably holds his Yukon Quest lead into the last checkpoint.
I just haven't seen anybody in a long time.
And that's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday, you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV.
A 4,000-foot mountain on the northern edge of Anchorage has a new name, Gold Star Peak. That's thanks to an Army veteran from Eagle River who has been campaigning for the name since last year, driven by an especially tragic day in Iraq. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin has the story.
For years, when he was a soldier based at Fort Richardson and after he retired, Kirk Alkire has climbed a mountain near Eklutna. It's called Mount POWMIA, and it has a flag that he tends to.
We climb it, and we replace the flag every time we go up. The weather that blows off Eklutna Glacier through that valley, if you will, is just it's punishing to the flags.
Mount POWMIA was named in 1999. Alkire says he didn't know when he started climbing the mountain that he would have a deeply personal connection to that ritual.
My last deployment that I did in 2006 and 2007 to Iraq is what kind of changed everything for me.
Four soldiers from Fort Richardson, from his unit, were abducted in a raid of their guarded compound in Karbala, Iraq. The bodies of Jonathan Chisholm, Sean Falter, Jacob Fritz, and Jonathan Milliken were found soon after. Alkire says the four were posthumously awarded the Medal for Prisoners of War.
During that process, the families were presented with those medals, and That was the very turning point for me in climbing that mountain.
They were not the only soldiers from the 425 Brigade Combat Team to die on January 20, 2007. Four others were killed that day by an improvised explosive device. In all, 53 soldiers from the 425 were killed in Iraq over the 15-month deployment. Alkire had 53 stainless steel dog tags made with their names. He says he carries the set with him almost everywhere.
Pretty much, especially when I'm out on an adventure. If I'm climbing or skiing or whatever I'm doing, adventure-wise, I took them with me to the Grand Canyon. I was just in Arlington in the cemetery visiting some friends, and I took them with me.
Alkire retired as a first sergeant in 2008 and now works as a civilian on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in the protocol office, handling VIP visits. Alkire says meeting the survivors of deceased soldiers is especially meaningful to him. They're called Gold Star families.
It's therapeutic for me to be able to talk with them and share a climb up the mountain with them. It means the world to me.
About a year and a half ago, on top of Mount POWMIA, it struck him that the peak just to the west should be named in honor of the Gold Star families. So he set out to make that happen. He filed an application with the federal government. He collected signatures and local support. Thursday, he presented his case to the U.S. Board of Geographic Names in Washington, D.C. The board approved it unanimously. Then it was on to the Capitol, where Senator Dan Sullivan honored Alkire and his effort in a speech from the floor of the Senate.
Families who have lost loved ones, who have made the ultimate sacrifice, serving their nation, will now be able to look up at Gold Star Peak as they drive up the busy Glen Highway in Alaska, and they will see that 4,000-foot peak soar into the sky.
Gold Star Peak and Mount POWMIA are connected by a ridge and accessed from the same trailhead on Eklutna Lake Road. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Charges have been filed against two Petersburg teenagers who allegedly hit multiple deer in town with their truck last week. The teenagers both say it was an accident. In court documents, they say they were trying to scare the deer for fun. They were not trying to hit the deer. But a video recording the incident could paint a different story, showing the teens hitting the deer with their truck and laughing about it. The teenager in the passenger side of the truck recorded it on video and posted it to the social media app Snapchat. Both of these teens are 17 years old. The video is taken from inside the truck and shows the vehicle approaching and then hitting two deer with a third one further up the road. It takes place in broad daylight on Wrangell Avenue in a residential neighborhood. Alaska State Troopers in Petersburg received the video on Wednesday and investigated. They've charged each of the teens with harassing game and one of them for reckless driving. Charges of harassing game could bring a $400 fine. Reckless driving is a misdemeanor. The troopers say, according to the video, the teens drove directly at the deer and did not try to avoid them. The teenagers admitted to hitting a deer the night before. They say the deer jumped in front of their truck. Troopers found deer hair on the truck and a broken headlight on the driver's side. Petersburg has a population of deer that are habituated to town. They raise their young around houses and yards, and they are regularly seen walking on the roads. A North Pole man is in trouble for shooting a wolf from the park's highway. Alaska State Troopers report 29-year-old Samuel Kendall was contacted by Fish and Wildlife Troopers on February 9th near milepost 258 north of Healy while he was dragging a dead wolf across the highway to his truck. Investigators say the investigation revealed Kendall illegally shot across the highway from his vehicle, which was parked in the lane of travel. Kendall was cited for shooting across the road and not having a hunting license. Bail was set at $570. The wolf carcass and rifle used in the shooting were seized as evidence. Alaska law prohibits salmon farming in state waters. That's because the farms and escaped fish could threaten natural salmon populations. Now Washington State is following suit in the wake of a massive escape of farmed fish. Its Senate passed a bill Thursday afternoon to get rid of Atlantic salmon farms in Washington waters. It would ban the practice after existing fish farm leases expire. Washington Governor Jay Inslee says the legislation is needed to protect native salmon.
We should be putting these millions of dollars into recovering native stock, not putting $1 million like we've done here, trying to chase Atlantic salmon to keep them out of our water.
A 250,000 Atlantic salmon escaped into Puget Sound from one of Cook Aquaculture's farms in August. A state investigation found the Canadian company's negligence caused the farm to collapse. Republican Senator Judy Warnick voted against the bill.
I am very, very disappointed that the path forward today is going to be the closure of an industry that has been very, very good for the state of Washington.
Salmon farms owned by Cook Aquaculture employ 80 people in Washington. Its leases expire in 4 to 7 years.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
The Southeast Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss possible federal subsistence fish and shellfish proposals and other subsistence-related issues and invites public participation at a meeting February 13th through the 15th, starting at 8:30 a.m. at the Vocational Training and Resource Center in Juneau. More at 800-478-1456. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Find out how you can include a gift to your public radio station through estate planning. Ask your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
Alan Moore appears on track to claim his third Yukon Quest title tomorrow. Moore arrived at the race's last checkpoint at Braeburn, hours ahead of the nearest competitor. Mushers have to take an 8-hour break at Braeburn before running the final 75 miles to the White Horse finish. Moore is eligible to leave just after 7 p.m. tonight, Yukon time, setting up an early Tuesday morning finish. Extreme cold has given way to warmer temperatures along the last portion of the trail, but accompanying snow and wind could slow progress to the finish. KUAC's Zoe Rome caught up with Alan Moore at the CarMax checkpoint.
Still in the lead, Alan Moore rolled into CarMax, laughing and encouraging his team.
People chase me, Alan. That's the bad news.
I just haven't seen anybody in a long time.
The warmer temperatures made for faster mushing and more enjoyable camping after brutal nights spent at temperatures as low as 40 below.
To endure those temperatures and back before Dawson when we had to camp out, you know, this, that, and the other, and being efficient, and it's really hard to camp out and be efficient when the temperatures are that cold.
A seasoned Quest veteran, Moore's strategy is to run his best race and not get overconfident, and let his sled dogs do their work. Moore has not dropped a single dog, and with the full team pulling his sled, the trails are refreshingly familiar. Led by dogs Dutch and Commando, Moore's excitement was palpable.
Just as coming into town, they sped up a lot. They knew where they were.
To keep spirits up, Moore sings to his team, mostly Christmas carols. On the Yukon Quest Trail in CarMax, I'm Zoe Rome.
Behind Alan Moore, defending Quest champion Matt Hall arrived in Braeburn this afternoon at 3.08 p.m., about 5 hours behind the leader, fellow Quest veterans Laura Neese, Paige Drobny, Ed Hopkins, and top rookie Vaybjorn Reitan are closely grouped in the 3 through 6 spots. 15 of the 26 mushers who started the race remain on the trail. Alaska cross-country skier Logan Hanneman takes to the snow at the Olympics in South Korea tonight. The 24-year-old, who grew up in Fairbanks, is one of 4 athletes the U.S. has selected to race in the 1.4-kilometer classic sprint. Hanneman and fellow U.S. skiers Simi Hamilton, Andy Newell, and Eric Bjornsson are in the field of 80 men trying to qualify for sprint heats. Hanneman is seated 44th in the qualifications race beginning at midnight Alaska time tonight. Logan Hanneman's older brother Reese is also on the Olympic team, but the U.S. only has 4 start spots for the men's sprint. The Hannemans and Bjornsson ski for Alaska Pacific University's program in Anchorage. Eric Bjornsson's sister Sadie is one of 4 athletes the U.S. team has entered in the women's sprint. The Bethel resident who won big on The Price is Right will not be paying hefty shipping costs after all. In fact, in an email, the television game show says it will cover all the delivery costs. The messages come after KYUK reported that game show winner and Bethel resident Joni Beckman would have to pay to ship her prizes from the lower 48. Beckham won $63,000 worth of prizes as a double showcase winner during an episode of The Price is Right that aired in January. Her winnings include 2 cars, a washer and dryer, a refrigerator, an oven, and more. Beckham had paid the taxes on the items and was calculating the shipping costs when the show contacted her, saying they had it covered. Fremantle Media is the production company behind The Price is Right. Vice President of Communications Christina Kirk wrote in an email that, quote, previous language noted there was a possibility that residents of certain states may have to pay for some of the shipping fees, but this is currently not the case. Kirk would not clarify when the policy had changed. Over the last year, warm water temperatures in the Gulf of Alaska, infamously known as the blob, have dissipated. Warmer water temperatures are thought to have a hand in massive bird die-offs and declines in Pacific cod, and now that the 3-year period of summer-like marine conditions is over, scientists and fishery managers are eager to assess the full impact of the blob. KBBI's Aaron Bolton has more.
The blob first showed up back in the winter of 2013-2014, after a high pressure system anchored itself off the west coast. That led to fewer blasts of cold Arctic air from the jet stream that would normally cool off the ocean. And National Weather Service climatologist Rick Toman says that also meant fewer storms in the Gulf of Alaska.
Or actually hardly any storms moving through that part of the Northeast Pacific. So we didn't get that mixing of the ocean layer that occurs when you get strong winds and big waves. That lack of mixing helped the water to wind up warming over a fairly large area.
The blob gathered plenty of headlines during its 3 years in the Gulf. It's thought to be responsible for declining stocks of forage fish that seabirds depend on, leading to massive mer die-offs. It's also known to have increased the prevalence of harmful algal blooms that can lead to paralytic shellfish poisoning. But there's plenty we don't know, and scientists like Chris Holdereed are now trying to put the pieces together. Holdereed works in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Kositsna Bay Laboratory near Homer, but she's also tied into Gulf Watch Alaska, a program that began monitoring marine conditions and marine life in the North Gulf just a couple of years before water temperatures rose.
To understand how these kind of marine changes in marine conditions affect the species, you know, everything from plankton to fish to birds to whales, you really want to see it happen when it's warm, when it's cold, when it's normal. And in a pretty short period of time, we've gotten to see all of that. So that part is luck.
Holdereed says the data collected by Gulf Watch and other scientists will help determine if and how other events, such as sea star wasting disease, are connected to warming waters. And piece by piece, scientists hope to get an idea of what to expect next time a blob-like event occurs. This big-picture approach isn't just of interest to the scientific community. Fishery managers are also changing the way they do things. Steve Barbeau is a research fisheries biologist with NOAA who collects data on Pacific cod, which saw a roughly 70% decline over the past 2 years.
I mean, before this event, I really didn't consider cod dying of starvation being really possible. In management prior to, say, 2010, we really were focused on single species. There are a few guys out there that are looking at the entire ecosystem. But since then, our program has really developed to kind of look at everything that's in the ecosystem to kind of tell us the story of what's going on. And I think that this event has really helped us focus for cod, specifically what those things in the ecosystem we need to keep an eye on.
Barbeau says among those other factors to keep an eye on is competition from other species. While the blob seemed to diminish the food supply for cod, leading to the decline, it may have actually increased the supply for pollock and sablefish.
And pollock happened to be up in the midwater column, and there were particular types of zooplankton that were abundant during that time period, and they seemed to do well. For sablefish, it might have been the same issue. They don't go down to the bottom. They were pelagic at those year classes, so those things may have helped out the sablefish and pollock equally.
Those species' success could make it more difficult for cod and other impacted species to recover. But the big picture answers scientists like Barbeau and Holdereed are hoping for may take longer in some areas than others.
If you were a sockeye salmon in, you know, 2014 and just heading out into the ocean, well, maybe you're just, you know, going to be coming back now. Or if you were a, you know, king salmon, right? You were affected by the warmer conditions early on. You were affected out in the ocean. Well, what did that all mean? We're not going to totally understand that until we see what's coming back in and how that changes. So some of these things have longer effects and are lagged. But I think it's exciting that we have all this information to put together and people working on it.
Near normal water temperatures are forecasted to stick around through the summer. And for now, most scientists can agree cooler water temps bode well for the ecosystem. Reporting at Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, John Ryan in Seattle, Zoe Rome in Braeburn, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Aaron Bolton in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m., only on Alaska Public Media TV. Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.